My counselor at the time said I should be a civil engineer. There were a lot of jobs for civil engineers. You know, I was good in math.
Probably pays better.
Yeah. So I'm standing in this long line of civil engineers, right? And I look over and the architecture school, the guy's sitting there all by himself. Nobody's talking to him.
Wow.
So I
looks
went
like
over
fun.
There and started talking to him.
So you're an architect because you don't like waiting in lines. Like that's what started.
Hi.
Hello.
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 Hello and welcome to Architecting.
Hi, welcome to Architecting. This is Rebecca here with Adam, the host of the podcast. Hey, Adam, who's on the podcast today?
Well, today, right now today, we have the Young Architect of the Year for Colorado sitting with us here. The 2023 AIA Young Architect of the Year, Rebecca Wagner. Congratulations. We just had a good award ceremony on last week, and Rebecca came away with that award. First time applying.
Very honored.
Yeah, big honor. Oh, geez, our kids are waking up from nap.
This might need to wait. Unless you want them on the podcast. Hold on, let me go get her.
Okay.
Maddie's asleep. Eli's the headphones are falling out.
Oh, okay, good. So we got the kids back to nap. It was funny, I didn't tell you this the other day. Like a teacher or somebody told me they asked Eli about the award that you got. And they said, oh, did your mom win a really big award? And he said, no, it was just kind of like medium size and it was just a piece of wood.
That's about right. That sums it up.
The actual award was just a smaller piece of wood, but yes, I think it was big. I was kind of hoping one of the kids would come out when we'd hear what they thought about architecture, but because it is a little fitting with our guest today, I think this might be the first single father architect that we've had on the show.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, so we have Ron Abbo on. This is a guy that I've obviously a pretty big figure within Colorado architecture, mm-hmm. and was awarded FAIA this year. I've been hearing a lot about him from a lot of community members, especially like Patricia Joseph, about just what a good person and leader he was. And yeah, he came over to our house and met him for the first time, or first time I've really talked with him for a long time. And it was just a great conversation. Just felt really deep and genuine and felt like we connected well. He's done a ton of things. He started his own firm 47 years ago.
Oh my goodness.
Graduated from CU in 1969. So we got into kind of a lot about what was that like graduating at that pivotal year and thinking about the power of architecture, especially within community design and activism. But yeah, I mean, he's one of the founding members of NOMA Colorado. He's been on the Asian Chamber of Commerce forever. He was the first minority president of AIA Colorado. He started the Minority Architect Committee within AIA Colorado. He's just done a ton of community involvement and also done a lot of architecture, a lot of projects that we get into here. Some good stories about the Denver Airport.
Hmm.
But yeah, fun. Does the Young Architect of the Year have anything else to add here?
Yeah, I heard him speak at a AIA Christopher Kelly event, and it's funny, right before you said it, I was thinking genuine is the word that comes to mind. Like, he was so engaging and genuine and humble and just like really, really inspiring.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, okay, I always say this, but I really enjoyed this conversation. So here, enjoy it too. Here you go.
Looking forward to it.
Hey, babe, it's me. I was just thinking about how you congratulated me on winning Young Architect of the Year, and I just feel so bad because I didn't mention that you also were on that stage that night getting a design award for your beautiful house project, and I just feel so bad that I didn't say it, so I wanted to say it now. I'm so proud of you, and that project is stunning, and you're a rock star, so yeah. Just wanted to let you know. Love you. Bye.
But first, here's a few messages from our sponsors.
Hey, we're happy to be sponsored by Modern in Denver Magazine. For over a decade, they've been crafting fantastically curated content on Colorado designers and projects, spreading the gospel of good design within our region.
And I love how the goal of Modern in Denver aligns with the goal of this podcast: to better build up and connect the community of Colorado designers. So go buy a copy of the magazine at your local bookstand, subscribe to their weekly email list, and follow them on Instagram.
Check it out.
And now, back to the show.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
I'd wanted to meet you for a while, and I ran into you at the NOMA
event.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And that was a good springboard again to invite you on here. But
well, great.
Yeah,
I'm excited here.
Yeah, this is good. Well, here, I'll start off with a nice awkward hard question, the hardest question. If you had two sentences to describe who are you, what would you say? Like a good part two sketch, you know, just a few lines.
So I am a third generation Sansei, Japanese-American architect, and I am a husband. I have a very wonderful wife, and I have 5 children and three grandchildren.
Wow. Nice. Yeah. When you said third generation, is that 3 generations of architects?
No.
Oh, okay.
3 generations of being here in the U.S. Yeah. So my grandparents immigrated in the early 1900s.
Oh, okay. I was getting really excited. I've never met like a third generation architect. I was like, this is a real wealth of information, knowledge. So let's dive into that. So are you from Denver? Or
no.
Is that what I heard?
So yeah. I was born in Idaho.
Oh, yeah. Huh.
And we moved here in 1952 when I was 6 years old. So I'm pretty much.
Yeah.
DNF Tower was the tallest building. There's no I-25, no I-70. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a real cow town back then.
But moving from Idaho, I mean, was it a pretty big city then?
It was, so it was a farming community in Idaho. My dad was a farmer. And so my grandfather, my father's father, first immigrated to Hawaii, worked in the sugarcane plantations, and Great Western Sugar operated the processing plant. They owned the plantation too. And they had a sugar beet factory in Idaho. So they liked the Japanese laborers, so they offered them land to rent and loaned them money for equipment. So there was this huge Japanese community in southern Idaho. Huh.
Did they show them pictures of what Idaho looked like compared to Hawaii? That doesn't seem like a great trade.
They were all laborers.
Yeah.
You know, Japan was going through some really economic hard times, and, you know, they just wanted to make a living. And the idea of, you know, having a place and having their own business, so to speak, being independent and having an opportunity to be in the United States. So he jumped on it. I guess he jumped on it. And
when, was that in the teens or something? They moved to Idaho
how old was he?
Year?
So
like, is it in the teens or the
1904?
20s? Oh, early.
1904. Right.
Wow.
And so they had five kids here. They left two daughters in Japan that they could never afford to bring them over here. And so they were farmers. My dad was actually the first to graduate college in his family as a commercial artist. And he graduated in 1940. And then the, you know, Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor in 1941. He had enlisted in the army because he was going to be drafted. And if you enlisted, it was, you know, less time to serve. But then when Pearl Harbor happened, they took all the Japanese soldiers along the West Coast. And he was in Fort Ord, California, and they moved him inland.
Really?
And then in 1944, they formed the 442nd Infantry Battalion, all Japanese American soldiers. And some of these soldiers were, you know, from the prison camps that were established during World War II, where they incarcerated all the Japanese Americans along the West Coast. And so he was a part of that unit.
Was your family incarcerated?
No, they were inland. So, you know, the Japanese Americans inland weren't incarcerated, but they were not, I guess, well received. And Governor Carr in Colorado was the only Western governor who welcomed Japanese from the West Coast.
Really?
When, you know, all that was happening, he said, you know, you can come to Colorado. And it ruined his political career because of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
When they came in, was it all kind of in a same location or scattered across the state?
So, you know, a lot
kind of community.
Yeah. So a lot settled in the kind of Fort Lupton area, Fort Morgan, kind of northeast along I-76, and, you know, we're farmers, farm laborers. Some became very successful. The Sakata Farms is very successful, and in Longmont, what's the name of the family? You can see the man's face. Anyway, you know, some became very successful. And there was a prison camp in southeastern Colorado, Granada. And so a lot of Japanese Americans stayed in Colorado and came to, you know, the Denver area. And so there was a Japantown along Larimer, Upper Larimer.
Really?
You know, around 20th, 19th, 20th. Up to 23rd. And so the Denver Buddhist Temple is at 20th and Lawrence.
Right. And so I interrupted you there. Did your father go to the Pacific Theater? Was he shipped out or was he?
They were shipped out. The 442nd was shipped to Italy first. And they fought around Pisa. And then they were sent to France along the German border, and it was a very famous battle because there was a Texas battalion that was surrounded by German troops on a mountain, and it was much like the mountains here, you know, heavy pine forests. And so the Texas battalion, which at that time was, there were only 200 men left, were defending, you know, that hill. The Germans were coming up the hill. And so they sent the Japanese American battalion in to save that Texas battalion. Wow. And so they were coming up. The Germans were firing up at the Texans. They were firing down at the Japanese. And these mortar burst would hit the treetops and just, you know, scatter. And so my dad was wounded during that campaign, and he spent several months recovering, and then they sent him back to Germany.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
And the war was over pretty quickly after that.
Yeah. And then what was his experience like when he came back? So did he come back to California and was still in the army, or
my mother moved to Salt Lake City then to be with, you know, the rest of her family. Mm. And so when my dad came back, he farmed with his brothers. You know, he was had a degree in commercial art, but nobody was hiring Japanese Americans then. Mm. So he just farmed with his brothers. And then in 1952, a friend of his had moved to Denver, opened up a service station garage right at 38th and Calumet.
Really?
Yeah, which cool. is a pizza place now.
Yeah.
Well, or I think it's now turned into a taco bar.
Yeah.
It's and just, a Pilates studio.
Yeah.
That's you know funny. Where it's
oh,
at?
Yeah, yeah. It used to be fresh pizza, and now it's a Kiki's Tacos. I think it hasn't opened yet. Right. But yeah, or maybe it has, but
yeah. Just before the underpass
yeah,
there.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. Well, that was my dad's
two blocks station. From where we're sitting right here, right now.
Yeah. Exactly. So he jumped at the chance and loaded us up in a potato truck and moved to Denver.
How many were you?
So it was my sister and myself and my mom and dad. My brother came later. He was born in Denver.
Hmm. And so that's when you were six.
Yeah, I was 6 years old. And actually, we moved. First, we moved to a little triplex around Colfax and Federal.
Hmm.
And so the school that I went to in first grade was Cheltenham Elementary School. And compared to the schoolhouse, farm schoolhouse in Hayburn, Idaho, it was a culture shock. There were, you know, African American, Mexican, Italians, Jewish, and you know, I came from this farming community where there were a lot of these Japanese Americans, you know, who had settled there from, you know, Hawaii, and it was a real culture shock.
Hmm.
And you know, it was not that far from the end of World War II. So a lot of the parents, you know, they wouldn't let their kids play with my sister and I because there's all, you know, this phobia against Japanese Americans.
Even with your wounded father who fought in Europe and...
Yeah.
Yeah. Was there... Did you come into a good-sized Japanese community here, or was it kind of just his friend?
No, and you know, the Japanese community here was pretty insular, you know, because they faced, you know, a lot of discrimination during the war, so they kind of banded together, and even, you know, we as Japanese Americans from another community didn't really integrate well with them either. So, you know, I went to Lake Junior High School and North High School, and, you know, you could count the Japanese Americans on one hand, you know, so there weren't a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese community in Denver was Curtis Park.
Oh, really?
Yeah, at that time.
And still kind of that Larimer area? As well,
Upper Larimer, what was mostly the businesses, but the people, you know, the families lived in Curtis Park, which is not too far from there. But.
Huh. So then, you know, it's really interesting. Your father getting the first college degree and it being an art degree, right?
Right.
Did that influence you a lot, even though he wasn't using it professionally? Was that...
Yeah, you know, he took a architectural rendering course when he was at the university, and it was a pen and ink wash in the kind of Beaux-Arts style, you know, very classical.
Yeah.
And it was, the problem was a terminus of a walk in a park.
Mm.
And so it had a kind of a domed structure with, you know, columns and very classical, right? Mm. And it hung in the living room.
Really?
And so I saw that every day. Right now it sits over my desk in my office.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, for the past 70 years, I've been staring at that picture.
I think about that, like there's two paintings at my parents' house growing up, and one was of a barn in a snowscape, and the other one was kind of a woman with probably another barn way off, but, you know, just going, like, taking naps or whatever, and you don't want to be taking naps, and you're just sitting there and you're staring at it, and I just stared at it over and over, right? Yeah. And it's right. In my head. It's but like so that
planted there.
That's so interesting, right. And it was essentially his own design, right? Like he wasn't rendering some other existing piece of architecture. He was kind of making something up,
I guess.
Yeah.
You know?
And so like you were kind of imbibing almost like his design in a way. And,
right.
And so how does it look to you now? Like, you know, do you, with an architect's eye of looking back to it, how did it kind of change?
I don't know if it's
or has it always just been
much.
Sort of there?
Yeah, I think it's just always been there. You know, it reminds me of home. It reminds me of him. You know, it also is kind of a dream unfulfilled
mm-hmm.
for him. You know, and I think maybe that's one of the reasons I became an architect, to kind of be that next generation that was able to do it.
Yeah. Right. And so you went through North High, and then was it a kind of obvious idea of, yeah, I want to go to CU for architecture, or what?
Yeah, you know, that's funny too, because, you know, I remember in like fourth grade, I was 10 years old, and we had this assignment, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, I want to be an architect, right? And I had no idea, you know, what that meant, or other than, you know, seeing this picture that my father had painted. And CU had a day where all the schools came down and at North, and it was in the auditorium, and, you know, there were various places where you could go talk to somebody from the various schools. And so my counselor at the time said I should be a civil engineer. There were a lot of jobs for civil engineers. You know, I was good in math.
Probably pays better.
Yeah. So I'm standing in this long line of civil engineers, right? And I look over, and the architecture school, the guy's sitting there all by himself. Nobody's talking to him.
Wow.
So I, you know, went over there and started talking to him.
So you're an architect because you don't like waiting in lines. Like, that's what started. I get that. Yeah, yeah. That's a personality type. I feel like civil engineers are better at waiting in lines. Yeah. So that started to influence you early on. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I kind of, you know, understood what it was and what it took to be an architect, and I was intrigued. And so I, signed up and was accepted, and, that was a long time ago.
Yeah. So that program was at Boulder at the time, right?
Right.
Yeah. And what was sort of the biggest surprise getting into architecture school and that whole experience for you?
I think the biggest part of it was the independence, I guess, and the responsibility of making your own decisions, right?
Mm.
It I was impressed that you had to come up with your own ideas, right?
Mm.
You had to form a kind of a conceptual idea of what it is that you're going to be designing. And then you had to draw it. And that was the hardest part. You know, that I think that's why architecture students have all the all-nighters, is because all this stuff is rumbling around in your head, and
there's no right answer.
Right. Yeah. You can't make the decision, you know, right, and then the panic sets in. You know, it's 10 o'clock at night and the paper is blank, and
then the adrenaline kicks in and the caffeine, and then you're good to go. Yeah. The fear, adrenaline, caffeine. Yeah. Architecture. I assume that was an even wider experience, right? Of even less diversity at Boulder at the time, and especially within architecture.
Exactly. You know, so out of our initial class of 40, you know, I was the only person of color. Actually, there was a Iranian student there, and we had two women.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
This was in the kind of late 60s?
It was in the late 60s, yeah. Right? So I graduated from North High School in 1964.
Okay. Man, what a time to be going and studying architecture. Obviously we can't understand what it's like to study architecture in another time, because we've only done it in our time, but that had to, I mean, did you feel the kind of radical societal forces and influencing the work and professors there that really pushed you?
Yeah. It was a time of change, you know. It was, you know, we had professors that had been there forever, right? Yeah. And then during my fourth year, there were, so Richard Whitaker, this is Whitaker, Turnbull, and Moore, Charles Moore.
Yeah.
They did Sea Ranch,
right?
You know, in San Francisco. Richard Whitaker became the director of design.
Huh.
And so he brought with him a few of his colleagues.
Yeah.
And they were young, long hair.
Nice.
Wrinkled clothes. You know, and then we had the other professors with their, you know, whales.
Chris White shirt.
Whales on their belt. And extra crispy shirts.
Yeah. flat top haircuts
right. And so that it was a interesting juxtaposition of, you know, styles and philosophies, and it was very heady. And you know, there were campus protests against Vietnam. There was, you know, civil rights marches. I mean, it was very heady times. So in my fifth year, we had the option to either do a traditional thesis problem or to be in a design center in Denver.
Hmm.
And I chose the design center, and partly because I was living in Denver, I wouldn't have to commute to Boulder, but also, you know, the opportunity of doing a real project. Doing real projects. I mean, we didn't know what those projects might be, but they would be working in the community.
Hmm.
This was during the Johnson administration war on poverty, called Model Cities.
Hmm.
And this is where nonprofit organizations could apply for grants to do whatever, you know. Do training, do food banks, design centers. And so we were housed with this group of counselors who were counseling people who were just getting out of prison.
Huh.
So they, you know, would help them, you know, navigate being not incarcerated anymore, you know, help them find housing and get jobs and get them settled and keep them from, you know, being incarcerated.
Right,
again.
Yeah.
And so there was a man who, he was a Black Panther.
Hmm.
Another a Hispanic man who lived in this neighborhood, a woman who had been in prison before, and another kind of radical white guy.
Hmm.
And so our professor had us do this deep dive sensitivity training for 2 weeks before we could even start thinking about a project.
Hmm. Who was the professor?
So, well, the director was Dwayne Newsom. I don't know if you've ever heard that name.
No.
And John Prosser. He was my professor.
Hmm.
And then there was Jack Williamson, who was one of Whitaker's colleagues. You know, he was the hippie guy. Lived in Nederland and, you know, dropped the F word every other sentence.
Yeah. Nice.
But he was our kind of day-to-day advisor, right?
And so you had the sensitivity training, and then you dove into the project, and what came out of it? What?
So the first semester was just kind of understanding. There were three centers that you could be in. One was the West Side, which was mostly Hispanic. West Side being like from Spear Boulevard to the railroad tracks and Colfax to Sixth Avenue, and then Northeast Denver, Five Points, Curtis Park, and then North Denver, this neighborhood.
Yeah.
So I was in West Denver, the West Side Design Center. And we were in an old house. Our first assignment was just to get the lay of the land. You know, where was... what was going on the West Side? Hmm. And so there were several organizations there, West Side Action Center and West Side Coalition. And they were all kind of different politically, right? Hmm. And the individuals were, you know, either more conservative or radical, right? Yeah. So it was an interesting experience, experiencing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then the next semester, our project, that my partner and I chose was Santa Fe had been a two-way street with head-in parking, right, on both sides of the street. They wanted to turn it into a one-way couplet with Kellam, right? Mm-hmm. And the neighborhood was like, oh, you know, we don't want this. What's it going to do to our, you know, neighborhood having these cars coming in at 45 miles an hour through our neighborhood?
So it was to speed up traffic and kind of make it allow way and yeah,
you know, the people from Englewood and Littleton to get to downtown Denver quicker.
Faster, yeah.
Right. So our project was to find an alternate way of, you know, making that happen.
Mm-hmm.
So we had several alternatives, including, you know, where the light rail tracks are now to realign the roadway to make Kalamath more the commercial street because it was wider, and leave Santa Fe alone because it was, you know, mostly retail.
Santa Fe was, I mean, in an urban sense, was the same as it is now, pretty close. I mean,
right.
the same, the buildings are, yeah, pretty much the same. Yeah.
Right. And we took it to city council. We took it to the well, first to the traffic engineers, of course, didn't want to hear it. And it was it was an interesting experience, you know, to really understand who was making the decisions and why, and where the power was, where the real power
was. Did you have
was.
Pretty long hair at the time?
Yeah. And it was black.
So you have that experience, and then you have to graduate at a certain point. And then what do you do with all that? You know, I mean, and you're graduating what, around 69 or 70 or
69, yeah. 1969. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Right. So I was going to be drafted. I joined the National Guard.
Really?
Yeah. And, went to work with a fairly traditional architectural firm. And then at that time, there were several of us in that design center experience that were, you know, working in offices in Denver, and we formed a nonprofit design center called Environment Incorporated. So EI for short was a vehicle that, you know, we would still do, you know, projects for community groups that couldn't afford it, or to be advocates for them, because, you know, like if Parks and Rec were going to do a recreation center, they would have a prototype that they would put in Washington Park or in Globeville.
Oh, really?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, they wouldn't consider what the needs of that specific neighborhood was. So my volunteer project was the Crusade for Justice. Crusade for Justice was the kind of the Hispanic equivalent of the Black Panthers, very radical, almost, you know, their philosophy was, you know, they would rather be a separate entity, you know, from the mainstream government.
Yeah. Was it the same kind of like building community centers and food for children and things like that?
So the project was, they had their headquarters was an old church building at 16th and Downing, and Corky Gonzalez was the, you know, head of the Crusade, and he wanted to establish a school for Hispanic youth that would teach them, you know, their culture, their heritage. And so I designed the school, basically, in the basement of that church, and then did an addition on the front of the church that would be more, you know, indigenous to their culture, rather than, and it was a very, you know, typical red brick, you know, Christian church facade.
And so I mean, you were in your early 20s
here, right?
And you were in the National Guard, and you were working for a traditional architecture firm, and you were
doing these things.
And did you have a family at the time, or were you?
We had a young, right?
Yes, yeah, so,
my oldest daughter.
Right. So was it the adrenaline and caffeine again powering you through all this? I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot to be doing, and just a lot of different headspaces. It seems like, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
it just seemed like that was, you know, I look back on it, and yeah, it was a lot, but. You know, it was all good.
Really?
Yeah. Huh.
And if I talked to your wife, she would say that was good back then too.
I'm divorced from her now. Okay. Maybe that's one of the reasons. Right?
it's funny. Like, I'll have a rough day or something and complain to my wife about it. And then the next day I'll be like, yeah, this week's been pretty good. And she's like, what are you talking about? You just had a horrible day. Oh, I forget about that. But I mean, just the, you know, I talked to so many people where architecture school is so impactful, right? And you have so many big ideas and then you get out and you have to get a job and it's this crushing kind of time. But for you to be able to continue that, this sort of community emphasis and to, I mean, you, that addition was built, I mean, ground up, like you had your own essentially ground up project pretty early
on.
It
wasn't, no. No, the addition wasn't built, but that, you know, they did convert the basement into classrooms. And the great part about it though, is I got to know the Gonzalez family.
Mm.
Oh my gosh. You know, I would sit and talk to Corky for hours. You know, we would talk about utopia.
Mm.
What would utopia look like? Right. And of course, from an architecture standpoint, you know, I had a different view of utopia in terms, and then, you know, thinking of mega cities and,
right,
you know, Paulo Soleri and
Super Studio and like,
yeah. And Corky was all about Mesa Verde and, you know, getting back to indigenous values and like that. And we'd had these great discussions.
And he, but because he was running a radio station, is that right?
No, Corky at that time, you know, he had been like chair of the Democratic Party. I think he was a legislator at one point, but his main source of income was real estate.
He was
a real estate. He had property, right? But you know, the crusade was his passion.
Right.
And he was the voice of the Chicano movement.
Yeah.
Right. He and Cesar Chavez and others were really the national voice for that movement.
And you really got connected to him through the West Side Design Center, or
you know, actually I don't know exactly how we first connected, but it was through Environment Incorporated, and you know, we would search for projects, you know, and just get the word out that we were out and available. The neat thing about it though is that Escuela Tlatelolco was the school, and eventually it became a real school. And his daughter, Nita Gonzalez, was the principal, director of it. So it first started at 41st and Tejon, out of Servicios de la Raza, was the organization, and they rented space to the escuela.
Huh.
And so in the 1980s, the city of Denver was getting community development block grant funds from the federal government. And prior to that, they were using that money for community type projects, recreation centers, community centers. And in the 80s, they started giving those grants to nonprofit groups. So Escuela was one of the first. And so we renovated a building for Escuela. And then eventually they got a building at 29th and Federal. We also helped them renovate that. I mean, they became like a career long client. They eventually disbanded. They had, you know, like any a group like that, funding problems. And so Escuela is no longer. But I think, you know, they changed a lot. And, you know, a lot of high school curriculums, you know, have some of what Escuela was teaching.
Mm. And you talked about when you first moved here, kind of feeling isolated in a way, right? Did you feel that discrimination going in through college and then upon graduation and looking for jobs, or in a certain way, like did being Japanese kind of help you float between different communities in Denver at all? You know,
I think so. You know, I think I was probably more accepted, you know, in the Black and Brown communities because I wasn't white.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I think I felt that because, you know, a lot of the, you know, having a beer after the meeting kind of talks, you know, would flow around the cultural experience.
Right. Right? Yeah.
You know, and, yeah. So I really enjoyed that kind of connection to those communities.
But then did it feel more difficult for you to get a job afterwards than other?
I don't know if it was so difficult getting a job, but you know, when I started my practice, it was during the OPEC oil embargo, mid-70s. And, the, you know, design community was just decimated because of it. You couldn't get a gas tap, you know, projects couldn't get funded. Government spending was non-existent. So a lot of firms were just laying people off left and right. By that time, I was a single parent at two young girls, toddlers, and you know, it was a challenge in those days, you know, being a single parent, especially male.
Yeah.
Being a single father.
Yeah, anytime being a single parent. And,
you know, being a professional, you know, and having to take off to because they're sick or, you know, daycare wasn't available or, you know, whatever. And so, you know, I wasn't given kind of the prime jobs.
What was the firm you were working at?
So during that time, I was working at the ABR partnership, which was Anderson Barker Rinker.
Oh, huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so I worked with John Anderson for a while. They split.
Yeah.
Okay. That's another interesting story, but I worked for John for a while, and then, I really wanted to work with Barker Rinker CCAT, so I quit Anderson's office. I went to Europe for a month, and I came back and I worked for BRS, and they ran out of work.
Oh, really?
And so
you said, "Hey, John, how you doing?" Yeah,
Martha Bennett, pal. Do you know Martha? Martha Bennett. She's Bennett Wagner Grody.
Oh yeah.
So she and I were let go the same day.
Wow.
So the woman, the minority single father,
yeah,
were let go. And I don't, you know, I don't fault them. I mean, when I decided that I didn't want to go out and look for another job, I did what I could, right? And so my first job was designing a porch or a deck for Ron Rinker's ex-mother-in-law.
Nice. Nice. I'm sorry to let you go, but as your severance, here's a porch. Yeah. I'll take it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I did kitchen renovations and, you know, house additions. And eventually that kind of grew into, you know, passive solar houses, you know, earth sheltered houses. I had a partner at the time and he had a brother-in-law in Vail, and we started doing a lot of, you know, mountain work, and they were passive solar houses, some off the, totally off the grid. So
because even Anderson was starting to get into that about at the time of the split, right? Like the community college came along. I just talked with Alan Gass.
Oh, okay.
And he was talking about that. Yeah.
That I worked with Alan on that project.
Yeah.
The Community College North campus.
That seemed like a real kind of experience by fire where there was just kind of no information on solar or very little, right, and having to kind of forge your way. So you were able to take that and kind of bring it into a single family world? Or I guess that was kind of a trend at the time, right? Early 70s. But
well, it was like, you know, energy was so expensive.
Mm.
And especially in the mountains, you know, in Vail, Eagle Vail, Beaver Creek area, you know, electricity was hardly even available up there. Mm. So, you know, we were designing passive solar or sheltered houses that, you know, did not need supplemental heat, right? Mm-hmm. And they get their power from a Honda generator.
Mm.
What little power they need for, you know, lights and like that.
Yeah. Wow, cool. And so, I mean, you know, I just started my firm a year and a half ago, and my third firm actually, but this round of it, and had an infant at that time and a young child, but had a supportive wife with a good architecture job. And so like thinking about you, you know, you're going off and two kids, single parent, a porch to start off with, you know, like what did you, I mean, obviously there had to be fear there, but were you just confident and determined that this is the path and I'm moving forward, or was it?
I don't know if I was so confident. You know, I mean, there were many times that I would question, you know, what am I doing? What?
Yeah.
Why am I doing this? You know, why am I beating my head against the wall? Why am I maxing my credit cards out?
You Why know? Did I leave that civil engineer line?
Exactly. You know, I remember I think the low point was, you know, my car wouldn't start, you know, it was winter. So I had an office in lower downtown, and I took the bus, and I hop on the bus, and the bus driver is this guy I was in architecture school with, who quit, you know, after the second year.
Huh.
He got a degree in medical, you know, as a lab technician.
Oh, yeah.
Right. But he's driving this bus, this RTD bus. And he's telling me, you know, the money he's making, and he had just built a house in this very classy area. And I think, oh my God, you know, my car won't start. I don't have any work.
Why did I try so hard? Oh man. And so what was sort of that first big project where, you know, you were like, I'm not just subsisting day by day, and like, I kind of made it. Like how far into the firm was that, and what was it?
You know, it was a couple of years into it, and I got connected to you know, physician who had money. They had a place in Evergreen. They wanted to do a house in Genesee. Mm. And Genesee at the time was just, you know, starting to get going. And so, you know, this was like, wow, ground up house, you know, with a couple of really neat clients. You know, they were very engaged and thoughtful, and, you know, had a great eye for design. And so, I thought, yeah, this is it. This is what I want to do, and this is why I'm doing it, right?
Yeah.
So I think that was it. That was a couple of years into having my own practice.
And jump to now. What was the anniversary you guys just had for the firm?
Well,
how long have you had it?
So I started the firm in 1976. So what is that?
Yeah.
46 years.
Yeah.
46 years. Yeah.
Wow. And I mean, so you have those kind of single family projects going on and the passive solar, but you've kind of built the firm on more, kind of renovation projects, like larger, like historical renovation, maybe, and more kind of governmental. And mm-hmm. how did the trajectory of the firm kind of progress?
Evolve.
Yeah, evolve.
So in the late 80s, the airport was being talked about, right? And kind of teams were forming, and the Mayor Pena was in office, first minority mayor for Denver, and so one of his initiatives was to create a MWBE program, Minority Women Business Enterprise Program, which you know other cities were adopting, and the Black and Hispanic contractors were very politically active at the time. And they were, you know, kind of driving this. And so a handful of us, Bert Bruton, Carol Massa, Roy Balls, Ron and Mike Roy Ball, you know, also talking to the contractors about professional services being included in, you know, an ordinance that would provide preferential procurement for minority and women-owned businesses.
Yeah,
I was a member of the AIA Denver. The AIA had a separate Denver chapter. I was on the board, and I created a minority business or a minority architects committee. And one of the charges of that committee was to develop a survey of minority and women businesses in the Denver area to, you know, determine capacity. Are there, you know, firms out there?
Right.
So we did. And back then it was not real well received by AIA or the mainstream architectural firms, because they felt like the women and the minorities were going to take
all the work, right?
Take the work away from them.
When the survey came back, how many minority or women-owned firms were there, or architects?
You know, you could count them on one hand.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, the ordinance was passed as a result of that. We were on a team that designed the concourse buildings out at the airport. And
was this after the Fentrist main hall?
No.
So they did the concourse buildings first, and
You know, you look at the concourse buildings and the central cores.
Yeah.
Well, that's what the terminal design was, times 10.
Huh.
You know, very, very lacy steel structure. You know, with the clear story lighting, like that.
That's what it was supposed to be.
That was
originally how it was.
Perez designed the original concourse building.
Who is that?
So it's Augie Perez. Huh. Augie Perez was from Louisiana, and he had a office here, but the story is the only reason he had the office here was so that he could write off his trips to his Colorado ranch. And so Augie was, you know, he was a businessman first, I think, before he was an architect. And anyway, Alan Brown, do you know Alan Brown? He's a he's an architect here. Well, he was a part of the Denver office, Luis Acosta. So LOA Architects, I think, is still around.
Oh, yeah.
I think Luis has retired, but he was he ran the Denver office. Anyway, Perez won the contract to design the terminal. And so it was this, you know, stepped up, formed structure. And then after the schematic design package was put together, they put it out for another RFP, and Fentress got the design development construction drawings. And that's when the tent structures were introduced, because it was a cost-saving, huge cost-saving measure. Required far less steel than, you know, what was the Perez design.
Because
our concourse buildings were patterned after, you know, the original
design. So they built yours and figured out how much steel was in it, and they said, hey, no, we can't.
Right.
So yeah, you were involved. So when you got that project, how large was the firm, your firm? And did you still have that partner?
No. By that time, I didn't have that partner. And so we had about 10 people.
Okay. Yeah.
An office in Capitol Hill. And it was the first computer that I had to buy.
This is late 80s.
In the late 80s, right? I think our contract started in 1989. And I bought the computer, I bought the software and a pen plotter for $25,000.
Oh, wow.
And
that's a lot of money. Yeah.
A year later, the computer was outdated.
No way.
You know, the plotter was broken.
Oh.
And I was still writing that $500 a month check.
Yeah. I know. I don't want to buy my $3,000 computer now in nowadays money. Huh. And that was like an AutoCAD? Was that AutoCAD at the time? Or
I forget what the program
was. Did it actually speed things up and help you, the program itself?
No. And so back then, it was you drew whatever needed to be drawn. And then you gave it to a CAD technician who was not an architect, you know, some
computer
19-year-old kid that knew computers, and they put the lines on the screen, right? But you get some really funny stuff back.
Well, and just so that you could plot off more sets, essentially, or...
It was the standard that the airport required.
Really? Huh.
Right.
Huh.
And they were floppy disks.
And so, I mean, how long did that project last? That took you a while. It was...
I think we were complete by 1992. The airport didn't open until, I think, 1994, but that was because the baggage system fiasco. Right. So the airport was complete, but it didn't have a baggage handling system.
Because it was that whole automated system, right? That was supposed to be very revolutionary, and then it didn't work. Is that
right? Right.
Huh.
Yeah. So I have all kinds of airport stories.
You know all the secrets, the Illuminati secrets down there?
Exactly. Yeah.
That'll be the bonus part.
So the airport director at the time was Bill Smith, and he was this crusty public works, you know, type guy.
Hmm.
I mean, he was He was a really nice man, you know, and very fair. But I mean, he was like, you know, you do what I say, right? So he gathers all the consultants for the concourse design, and he says, I want you to design me a concourse, and I'm going to repeat it 2 more times. And I'm going to pay the civil engineers, you know, to adjust the ground, but I'm not paying you guys anything more for reuse. So we designed a concourse, and Concourse E at Stapleton was the last concourse to be designed there. And it had all the moving walkways on the mezzanine, right?
Mm.
So we had the working drawings done, and the Continental Airlines was the first tenant to sign a lease. And they said, we don't want our passengers to have to take the train. And since there's no walkway down in the tunnel, we want a bridge to our concourse. And there was a international concourse on the end of the terminal. And they took that away so that they could move all the concourses up to create the bridge.
Hold on. For the right. bridge that goes from A to the,
to the terminal.
Yeah. Huh.
And then Continental said, you know, we don't want those moving walkways up on that mezzanine. We want them down on the concourse level.
Hmm.
So we had to widen the concourse by 8 feet. And it affected every drawing.
Oh, man.
Every sheet. So,
can't just cut the floor plan in half and just make a little white space. Just tape a new piece in there. Oh, man.
So then United came on as the second tenant. They said they want a Concourse B, and they said, you know what? We want 2 sets of moving walkways. So we had to widen another 8 feet. So we designed 3 concourses.
And you got paid for one?
No, we got paid for 3.
Oh, you did? Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. I thought they were going to stick you with that.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So then, I mean, after that project, that had to be a huge educational project of just working at a different scale, probably. And did right. that help you kind of jump scales and project types?
Yeah. You know, so more into the, you know, the government sector. But then, you know, I merged with another firm in Boulder, and brought on 4 partners, and their project base was laboratories, research and pharmaceutical laboratories, and
was it just getting too kind of big for you to be doing yourself, or what was the idea of merging?
It was, you know, to broaden, you know, the base, you know, of clients and project types, and also, you know, having additional partners.
Right. That's a lot of hats to wear by yourself.
Yeah. The owner of that firm, Jim Copeland, actually did not really need to practice architecture. He had, you know, family money.
That kind of architect. Yeah.
Nice guy. And his vision was to, you know, exit the firm. I mean, that's why he wanted to merge, right? So after a few years, we physically merged in the firm in Denver, and we were, you know, a firm of 22 people, had a office in Uptown, and we were humming along, and then 9/11 happened.
Mm.
And it was like walking off a cliff.
Mm.
You know, we had a lot of developer kind of project, pharmaceutical companies, a lot of private work, and it just decimated the firm.
Wow.
So we had a contract with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, which is a private company, but they got DOE funding. And so all of their projects were tied to, you know, federal procurement laws and like that. And in the federal space, you don't start a project until you have the money, right? And the people that are running the projects, they're professionals. You know, they're either architects, they're engineers, they're former contractors, project managers. You know, they're not somebody who doesn't know construction, design or construction. So I decided to move more into the public space. Then I applied for 8A status, government, federal government, SBA 8A status, which is socially disadvantaged business.
Hmm.
And in the 8A program, you can, the federal government can set aside projects for 8As, except for architects. Architects, at least, you know, it's a qualification-based selection. But for 8As, they had to look at the qualifications of at least three 8A architectural firms because of the Brooks Act. And so a lot of the 8A set-asides, we wouldn't, well, every time a project comes out in the federal space, they have to go to SBA to see if that project to go to one of their procurement specialties like 8A or Hub Zone or women-owned business or veteran-owned business, these you know, procurement vehicles for, you know, some disadvantaged sector of society. But in a lot of cases for 8A, they couldn't because there weren't three architects. So we would actually call 8A architecture firms to say, you know, you'd be interested in submitting a proposal on this, you know, and at least it would give somebody, you know, in that 8A world an opportunity.
Hey, we're happy to be sponsored by Modern in Denver Magazine. For over a decade, they've been crafting fantastically curated content on Colorado designers and projects, spreading the gospel of good design within our region.
And I love how the goal of Modern in Denver aligns with the goal of this podcast, to better build up and connect the community of Colorado designers. So go buy a copy of the magazine at your local bookstand, subscribe to their weekly email list, and follow them on Instagram.
Check it out.
But it got us into the federal space. And, you know, the federal government is a difficult client. Not difficult, but complicated.
Right.
Client to work for. But, like I said, you know, if they have the money, then, you know, the project will go. You know, they won't advertise the project unless they have the money, right? And you are working with professionals. Their contracts also generally are multi-year contracts. So they're like, they call them IDIQ, indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contracts, right?
Nice.
And so it could be a boiler replacement or it can be the design of a new research laboratory. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you take what you get. And they have several of those contracts. So first of all, they ask you for your qualifications. Have you ever done anything like this before? But they don't ask you for fee. And then they'll select, you know, somebody out of their IDAQ pool, and then they ask them for a proposal, for a formal proposal. And it's been a good deal for us. There are, Colorado has the most federal installations here than the Beltway.
Really? It has more than the Beltway?
No, not as more, but... The Beltway has the most, and then Colorado's really? The second.
Huh.
Yeah. That includes the military bases yeah. that are here.
And so you came out of 9/11 and the firm kind of broke up, and is that when you went back on by yourself and then
yeah.
picked up this kind of line of work?
Right.
Yeah, and rebuilt the firm in that sense. And looking back, were you able to carry that thread and be carry that satisfaction from kind of your 1969 self and that Corky Gonzalez, like you're able to pull that through even with the kind of federal work and the larger work and
you know there are projects that we do that you know for nonprofit groups. I'm on a board of a nonprofit child welfare organization. And so I've been on this board over 20 years, and I've been president of the board for the last 7. But we're doing a project for them right now that this group used to have a residential treatment center for boys, adolescent boys. And these are boys that were taken out of the home because of abuse or neglect or criminal behavior. And so Savio House would take up to 28 boys, you know, feed them, clothe them, take care of them, educate them, provide them therapy, you know, if they needed it. Well, the model has changed that it's not that kid that's in trouble, it's the family.
Mm.
And so we are doing the first model in the nation of a family treatment center where we would take, and these would be families with substance abuse that maybe are either homeless or on the verge of homelessness, put them into a basically a townhouse, 3-bedroom townhouse, and treat them for up to a year as a family. And so whatever their issue, well, first of all, you know, the substance abuse or alcohol abuse issues, if there are, you know, other physical abuse and neglect issues or, you know, the kids are, of course, having maybe feelings of abandonment,
right,
you know, like that, so that it's treating the whole family with whatever issue they have. And so it's a 6-unit townhouse in Lakewood with an attached staff quarters and counseling rooms for the families. So we're doing that.
Yeah. And you were able to design those spaces? Yeah. And create that environment for... Yeah. Well, that's cool. You know, it's like, I feel like we could... With your life, we could do another 2 hours, 3 hours here. I feel like I have all these notes and like we've barely kind of scratched the surface on a lot of this. But, you know, obviously I'd known about you for a long time, but then was able to go to the NOMA holiday party. And it was really, it was such a cool event. And you were given this big award of the mentorship. What was the title of that? I had that mentorship excellence, right? And like I could just, you know, there's this young and vibrant NOMA chapter here, and it was so cool to see, just the figure that you are within that community. And you know, you were talking about when I when I first started, you could count the minority architects on your one hand, right? And,
right.
You know, obviously they're still minority, right? But growing community and again, vibrant to see you as the kind of like, you know, this figurehead in that is so cool. And just the impact that you've had on the community in that sense. And then with the board of the Colorado Board of Professionals, right? You were one of kind of the founders of that. And then congratulations on the FAIA this year, right?
Oh, thank you.
I really appreciate you coming on here and telling your story and for everything you've done for Denver. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It was a pleasure, Adam.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed it.
Thanks.
You can visit architecting.com. That's architect-ing.com to see images from this week's guest.
And please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.
Have a great week and keep connecting.
Hi, I'm Eli. This show is made by my mom and dad. And these people.
Heidi Mendoza. Emily Childs.
Fernando Queiroz.
Zach Huff.
Trevor Motzko.
Aaron Best.
Kyle Brunner.
Rob Cleary. All right, let's get a coffee. See ya.
This is Sarah Hubbard, host of You and Me Kid, a podcast about starting and raising a family on your own. We just launched season 2, and I'm speaking with single moms, those still considering, and experts in relevant fields to give you a real sense of what the day-to-day experience of solo parenting looks and feels like. Plus, this season, I've partnered with California Cryobank, the number one sperm bank in the U.S. So wherever you are in the process, this podcast provides some support, humor, and helpful information. Listen to You and Me Kid wherever you get your podcasts.